Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show was Warrior Goddess by Lisa Thiel, one of my favorites, actually. Well, I wonder if you've heard about the upcoming Goddess Conference in Malibu, the first weekend in September. You know, it's right around the corner, and if you're interested, you should register now. According to the organizers, they say the goddess is rising. Well, they won't get any argument from me there. They go on to say, we invite you to join us for 3 magical days of celebration, ceremony, and workshops in the breathtakingly beautiful coastal hills of Malibu with world-renowned presenters, music, dancing, and feasting, plus vendors, artists, divination, belly dancing, archery, drumming circles, and much more. They believe it's going to be a truly transformational and heart-opening experience, and they hope you'll attend all 3 days. They say it's the first ever Southern California Goddess Conference, and that's certainly true. It's called Goddess Spirit Rising. The ad says, as we gather together at legendary Camp Hess on the majestic coastline of Malibu, California, we have 3 days of powerfully sacred workshops and rituals led by transformative, inspirational presenters and musicians from all over the world, plus a beautiful red tent temple experience. We have goddess-inspired musical performances. Entertainment will include a wide array of goddess music and musical performances, ritual drums to stir the ancient self awake. We have a crystal-clear swimming pool for the heat of the day, plus endless California coastline to explore. All of nature is just a step outside your cabin door, and wonderful souls to share the whole experience with. You can attend the workshops, listen to music, you can shop with the vendors, you can walk amongst nature, or you can just rest. What do you do when it's up to you? Well, all of their tasty meals are prepared for you. There's no work duty. There's no food to cook. There's no dishes to do. The camp staff does it all for you. At night, they celebrate the goddess energies through music, rhythm, and ecstatic dance in sacred ritual space. Light a fire in the center of our sacred ritual space deep in the heart of the coastal woods, and then we gather round. We sing, we dance, we worship the goddess, we recognize the divine in each other, we celebrate life together. So, for more information about that, please go check out the website. It is goddessspiritrising.com. There's a lot more information there, including the schedule and all the presenters and the cost. So that is Goddess Spirit Rising, the first weekend of September in Malibu. So, turning our attention to tonight's show, first we have up Starhawk with us, chatting about how things are moving along with her film, The Fifth Sacred Thing, followed by Malgorzata Oleskiewicz-Peralba, that's a mouthful. She's calling in, discussing her book, Black Madonnas, Unofficial Saints and Fierce Feminine Divinities. Among the standard Black Madonnas, we'll chat about a modern manifestation of the dark goddess archetype that's known to many. One is called La Santa Muerte, as well as Baba Yaga, Pambajira, Kali, and many more. So, without further delay, I want to welcome Starhawk to the show by way of her bio. I can't imagine most of you don't already know Starhawk, but just in case, because I know I have new listeners all the time, new people to paganism, to goddess spirituality, so let me tell you a bit about her, and then we'll start our chat. She has an extensive bio, so this is just a little snippet. She's the author of 11 books on goddess religion, earth-based spirituality, and activism, including The Spiral Dance, The Fifth Sacred Thing, which is being turned into a film and primarily the focus of our talk tonight. Also, The Earth Path, and her picture book for young children, The Last Witch, winner of the Silver Nautilus Award. Her 12th book, The Empowerment Manual, which we've talked about here on the show, if you look back in the archives, is a guide for collaborative groups, published in November 2011. Features group dynamics, power, and process for directly democratic groups, and especially relevant as we, you know, try to get together some sort of grassroots movement like the Occupy Wall Street was. Stuart Hawk is a filmmaker who's worked on 4 documentaries with director Donna Reed Cooper, including their latest, Permaculture, The Growing Edge. She's currently working with Yerba Buena Films. They're the production company for her Fifth Sacred Thing film. She's one of the founders of the pagan spiritual network Reclaiming and directs Earth Activist Trainings, offering permaculture design courses with a grounding in spirit and a focus on organizing. She blogs at starhawksblog.org. Her website is starhawk.org. For more on those films, you can go to Belili, BELILI.org. And for more on her movie and book, The Fifth Sacred Thing, the website is fifthsacredthing.com. So, Starhawk, welcome to the show. Whoops. Sorry, just a second. Hi, Starhawk. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thank you so much. I've been looking forward to talking to you and trying to get the gist of how things are going with the film. I was wondering if you mind talking a little bit about the sort of the theme of the book and the film, just in case some of the listeners out there are new to all of this. You know, tell us a bit about the Fifth Sacred Thing. You know, what values will it teach the world?
Sure, but first, I just want to wish everyone a happy Lammas Eve. It's one of our sacred holidays starting tonight and tomorrow that celebrates the beginning of the harvest season, the summer harvest. And it's a time kind of standing between hope and fear. And for me, it has a lot of relevance, actually, to The Fifth Sacred Thing, which started as a novel that I wrote back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was thinking about some of the questions that I'd been dealing with in other ways in my earlier nonfiction books. Really, the question of how did we come from, you know, cultures that were goddess-oriented, that were earth-based, that celebrated life and sexuality and honored women way back in the early times, how did that transform into these patriarchal, warlike cultures that we're still in today? And what could we do about it? You know, how can we transform our world back into something that's sane and sustainable and actually nurturing for people?
Well, and you know darn good and well there are people out there that want to have us believe that it was always this way. It was never any different. And how could it possibly be anything but we have right now? You know, it's sort of like, this is it. That's all you get. You know, we can't do any better as a species.
It's the Tina, that there is no alternative. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I had been writing a book called Truth or Dare, Encounters with Power, Authority, and Mystery, and doing a lot of research on this transition to patriarchy back in ancient Sumer. And one of the things that really came home to me was that this whole transition to a world of hierarchy and a world where some people have value and other people don't was intricately bound up with war and with war as an institution. And it was kind of a feedback loop that once one culture became conquerors and became warlike, other cultures either had to respond by becoming warlike themselves, or they got conquered, or they had to get out of the area and try and go somewhere else. So in writing the fifth sacred thing, I was really looking at the question of, you know, how could we transform this back? How could you actually defend yourselves in a different way? Is that even possible? And I
so,
had been
in other words,
very
don't turn, in, don't turn into what they are in order to change the world, in other words.
Exactly, yeah. And I had been very involved in doing a lot of nonviolent direct action around anti-nuclear stuff and intervention issues in Central America back in the 80s. You know, and we were practicing nonviolence, but I felt we were practicing it in an atmosphere that was relatively benign, where we weren't risking, you know, at that time at least, we weren't risking torture or, you know, usually risking long years of prison. But I wanted to explore the idea of what if you had a really ruthless enemy, like the people we were supporting in Central America were often facing, what could you do then? And so I wrote a novel called The Fifth Sacred Thing, and the novel actually starts on Lammas, on what they call the Day of the Reaper, on the celebration of the 20th anniversary of the uprising that Northern California succeeds in carrying out in 2028 against the advent of this sort of fascist takeover that call themselves the Stewards. But in Southern California, it goes the opposite direction. Northern California becomes a place where people really live in harmony, where they develop a culture in balance with nature that's honors all the different heritages of people, that's truly non-racist, truly diverse, and really values art and music and pleasure. But Southern California, unfortunately, becomes very different, where it's very strongly militarist and hierarchical and fascist. And when the South invades the North, the people of the North struggle with the issue, how do we defend ourselves without becoming what we're fighting against?
Right. Well, can you give us some hints without giving away the whole book and the film?
Well, the story centers around three main characters. There's Maya, who's the old woman and the storyteller, whose life really spans the whole mid-20th to mid-21st century. There's her grandson, Bird, who's a musician, but who's gone down to the Southlands to fight and been captured and is in prison when the story begins and escapes and comes back to the North. And then there's Madrone, who's, as Maya puts it, she's the daughter one of my lovers had by my other lover when my back was turned. Actually, she's the granddaughter of the daughter of that daughter. And she's Bird's longtime sort of childhood sweetheart, lover. And she's a healer, and she's fighting off the epidemics that are bioengineered by the Stewards. And so when the story begins, Bird escapes, comes back, warns the city that war is coming, and they have to struggle with the issue. How do they fight? Madrone goes down to the Southlands to try to help the resistance and to try to find answers for how they can actually ward off these engineered diseases. And Maya has a vision, and her vision, which comes right after the Passover Seder, the prophet Elijah comes to her, and she has an argument with him and tells him, you know, you're an old patriarchal bastard, you know. Get out of my bedroom, you know, fraud. And he tells her, Maya, you know, don't you think I might have changed over the centuries? There's a Jewish tradition on the Seder that you set a place for Elijah at the table. He says, you know, for generations, Jewish women have been setting a place at the table for me. You know, what happens to the enemy who's invited to join the feast? Does he not transform? And he tells her, you know, you tell your enemies this, there's a place for you at our table if you are willing to join us. So Maya has this vision that's really a vision about nonviolent resistance. We won't cooperate with enemies. We won't serve the soldiers in any way, but we also won't fight them. We won't try to kill them. We will invite them to join us, because the truth is that the ordinary soldiers in that army have no real reason to have allegiance to the system they're fighting for, and have every reason to come over to our side. And if we can, you know, maybe we can win not by killing their army, but by transforming their army and taking the army away from them.
So let me ask you. I love the premise, but what comes into my mind is you see poor people in the South who vote against their economic interests all the time and vote Republican. I'm thinking, you know, we couldn't invite them to sit at our table. The polarization is too great. You know, we saw the militarism of the police against the Occupy movement when, you know, those Occupy people were trying to get things done that would have helped the police. So in goddess spirituality, we know that the goddess civilizations were overrun by the warlike cultures, you know, of the war gods. You know, they had no fortifications and all of that stuff, so they were eventually over time either, you know, assimilated, obliterated, you know, different things happened in different places. Can that work, I guess? You know, I mean, can it, you know, does it have a realistic chance of working, and the people who are passive not just get steamrolled?
Well, I think that we, you know, have seen some really victorious nonviolent movements in this last century. And, you know, there's nobody will say it's easy. But we've seen the Soviet Union fall with the Velvet Revolution. We've seen the Arab Spring, you know, where dictators were toppled again by a primarily nonviolent movement. And the way that, you know, if we're going to look at nonviolent theory as opposed to just fiction, you know, strategic nonviolence actually doesn't necessarily expect that you're going to win over all the hearts and minds of the people who are opposed to you. It's nice, and it's, you know, it's always worth a try. But what it says is that when you have a system of injustice, like the civil rights, you know, situation in the South, when you had segregation, that's a system of embodied violence. You know, every time a black person had to drink in a separate drinking fountain, or, you know, couldn't go to a bathroom, or couldn't sit at a lunch counter, in effect, they were suffering an act of dehumanization, which is a form of violence. But when that violence is so embedded in the system, people don't see it. They don't experience it that way. Mm-hmm. When you do something like the civil rights movement, and you go and sit at the lunch counters with black people and white people together, then you put the system in a dilemma. Either they have to allow you to break this unjust law and the law changes or takes a hit or becomes less enacted, or they respond with police and arrest, and then the violence inherent in the system becomes visible, and the system starts to become delegitimized.
Is that what happened with the gay marriage? Is that how?
I think that's very much what's happened with the gay marriage. That, you know, as gay people became more and more visible, and as the issue became more and more visible, and as the inherent injustice of it became clearer to people, you know, people just sort of went, you know, well, why? What is this? Why not? If people want to get married, they should be able to get married. And,
well, that,
you know, and I think that was Harvey Milk's, you know, and the early organizers in the gay liberation movement, you know, that was their genius to say, no, we aren't going to win our rights by being invisible, by passing, by pretending that we're not gay. We're going to win our rights by being visible, by being out there, by speaking out, by showing people who we are. And then people, you know, are going to get used to it. And then people are going to realize that, you know, they've got friends, they've got brothers, they've got cousins, you know, they've got teachers, they've got doctors, they've got gay people all over in the community. And it no longer becomes this thing that's so strange and so fearful.
So you create, it's almost like during the transition, you have two sets of normals until the new normal takes over.
And so I think now with the Occupy movement, you know, it had some tremendous successes early on. And I think one of the reasons it spread so quickly early on were a few really key incidents, like when the police pepper sprayed those young women on the bridge, you know, where suddenly the violence in the system became so visible, it mobilized everybody's outrage, and people were all saying, yes, these people have a point, you know.
Right.
That's right. Let's go sit in the public square until something changes.
So do you think, say, for instance, the Trayvon case, you know, the Zimmerman trial, and the Republicans going crazy, taking away voter rights, do you think that's going to be the next big push we see for, do you think racism maybe is going to fall before sexism?
You know, I'm not going to predict which it'll be, but I will say we need outrage and we need mobilization around so many different issues. You know, and racism and sexism are inherently tied together. They are not really separate systems or separate isms. They are, like Louisa Teach always calls them, the ism brothers. You know, they are the same family. They are all part of an overarching system that says some people have more value than others, and they have the inherent right to control the resources and impose punishment on others. You know, some people are worthy and other people are just there kind of as filler.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote a blog entry recently called Embracing the Other, and tried to make the point that more and more of us are becoming the other. You know, the elderly, the poor, black and brown skinned, you know, gay, environmentalist, you know, it's almost like it's all of us versus, you know, white male patriarchy, Christian patriarchy. At least that's how I'm seeing it. You know, if I'm wrong, correct me. But it's almost as if we all stood shoulder to shoulder, just like the lesbian gay community with transgenders. They didn't let themselves be divided. You know, they didn't create any wedge issues among themselves. And if we could all do that, I mean, there are so many more of us than them. You know.
Yes, and I think, you know, we see, along with voters' rights under attack, we see women's rights, we see abortion rights and our right to choose what happens to our bodies, you know, being assaulted. And, you know, and what's interesting is that these issues, you know, like it used to be 10, 20 years ago that the right wing could use these issues to mobilize their base, you know, and get out the vote and, you know, get a majority of people on these social issues to vote against their own interests on economic issues. Now, the truth is that the support for them on these social issues is eroding away really quickly and dying off. As the older generation dies off, the younger generation, they don't care about whether you're gay or not gay, really. You know,
isn't the challenge though to get the Tea Party out of Congress? Though, I mean, they're gumming up all the works.
Well, that's it. They are only succeeding now because they are overtly obstructive, and because they've gerrymandered these districts, you know, because they have imposed these things, you know, it's like they're not fooling people anymore. They don't actually have a majority of support anymore. They can't pretend that they have a majority of support. Unfortunately, they have enough of a minority that they can still obstruct a lot of progress.
Well, and, you know, maybe I'm not very realistic, but, and, you know, and these are my words, not yours, so, but, you know, it almost feels like to me it's traitorous or treasonous. I mean, we're always talking about democracy. We'll go, you know, we claim to go start wars for democracy, but yet, you know, here we have a Republican Party that's, you know, taking away voter rights, that's gerrymandering districts. I guess, you know, maybe it's just because states' laws are all different, but can you explain how they can get away with it and nobody, even in the media, even people like the Rachel Maddows or the Tom Hartmans or the Amy Goodmans, why they're not saying, you know, this is, you know, this is traitorous?
Well, I think that there are voices out there that are saying that, I think it's really important for all of us, you know, to be supporting, like, the Amy Goodmans and supporting the alternative news services that actually are bringing us, you know, real reporting about things like the Bradley Manning trial that's been going on and the other
right.
things
I wanted
happened.
To talk to you about that a little bit, too. I wonder if you think Bradley Manning and Snowden, are they signs that things are crumbling, you know, that patriarchy is crumbling even more? Mm-hmm. That is that a, are these, you know, the sacrifice that these people have made, do you think this is going to further along this shift that we're all hoping we see in our lifetime?
Well, I think that they have both done us a tremendous service, and I really honor the sacrifices that they have made, which are, you know, which are huge and enormous, because what they have done, again, is to make this inherent, invisible structure of violence and control visible. And when it's visible, then we can see it, and then we can be empowered to do something about it.
Well, have you, I wonder what your thoughts are on something I saw recently. I don't know if it's real recent or maybe I just, you know, got wind of it. I saw an article about in Britain, they're talking about maybe starting to censor websites, especially maybe esoteric and pagan websites. Of course, they say pornographic things and, you know, suicide websites and, you know, different things like that, but they're lumping in with that, you know, pagan websites. Of course, they won't lump Christian, you know, stuff in there. But I guess I'm starting to really get concerned that the internet is, you know, such a tool of ours, and it might, you know, we might see it be under a real threat because it's such a tool for, you know, grassroots movements.
Well, I think, you know, with any threat to our movements and our organizing or any attempts to suppress us or to silence our voices, the important thing is to understand that we need to take that political space and hold it. You know, we protect our rights by exercising them, by using them, by speaking out, by using the internet, by organizing on it, and by not being silent. And I see people all the time get themselves wound up in anxiety and fear about what's going to happen. And you get these revelations like the extent of the NSA spying, and you can easily spiral into a panic, you know. But then, in some ways, you're doing their work for them.
Right.
If anyone out listening ever silences yourself because you're like, oh, I'm afraid if I say this, I'll get in trouble, you're doing their work for them. Make them do the work. If they're going to silence you, make them work hard for it and organize people to prevent that. And I think that there are, you know, a lot of very strong and powerful counterforces that can prevent, you know, it can keep the internet. The wonderful thing about the internet is it's so big, it's so sprawling and so disconnected, you know, that it is hard to control. And hopefully we can keep it that way.
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the other things, you know, I've been wondering, too, is, I mean, do you have any theories about why there aren't more people in the streets? Or we just aren't, I mean, are too many people just too comfortable and complacent and, you know, enough people aren't suffering? I mean, I've been waiting for people to hit the, big numbers of people to hit the streets for a couple of years now. And I just don't understand what it's going to take, you know, for us to have our own, you know, Egypt Spring or whatever you call
uh-huh.
it. You know, I don't get it. You know, are too many of us just too comfortable?
Well, you know, in some ways, it's always a mystery as to what creates that moment where everyone turns out. When those moments happen, people rarely see them coming ahead of time. I was in Argentina a year before their whole uprising against the International Monetary Fund back 10, 15 years ago. And I was doing nonviolent direct action trainings with some of the activists there, and all the activists were complaining, we can't get people out in the streets, we can't get people to do anything, you know, we can't organize ourselves out of a paper bag. And then a year later, the whole thing erupts. You know, with Occupy Wall Street, when that demonstration happened, nobody expected it was going to become this huge movement. You know, everyone thought, oh, great, another demonstration, like 10 dozen others that the usual suspects turn out for. And that was what it was like for the first few days of it. First couple, you know, week or so, I was seeing all of these articles on the lefty internet press saying, you know, why isn't the media covering Occupy Wall Street? You know, why isn't even NPR talking about it? You know, and then suddenly there was that incandescent moment after those young women got pepper sprayed, and suddenly it took off, but no one would really have predicted it. You know, I am friends with a man named Ahmed Salah, who was one of the organizers of the Arab Spring, and he's told us the story of how they got people out on January 25th, and he said his biggest fear about it was not that he was going to be arrested, which he had been, or tortured, which he had been in the past, you know, or tear gassed. His biggest fear was that it was going to be a complete failure. Nobody was going to come out for it. So I think there's an aspect of this. Again, you prepare the ground, you organize, you do what you can, you try to educate people, and you try to mobilize people, and you try to inspire people and empower people. But when that magic moment happens, you know, like I said, I think it's a mystery.
Well, and I wonder too. I mean, you know, I'm not an expert on, you know, mm-hmm. activism like you are, but when we have such a militaristic police,
mm-hmm.
You know, and even when you are passive, I mean, can you succeed when, you know, we literally have police that look like snipers and, you know, military commandos? You know, and seem to be so quick, you know, to, you know, get violent themselves, even when the people who are protesting aren't violent.
Well, first, don't equate being nonviolent with being passive, because
okay.
it's not being passive. It's being very active.
Okay.
Being active, it's literally taking action. It's simply not
nonviolent.
Doing so in a way that
yeah.
involves weapons or, you know, hitting back at somebody. But it's a very active form of resistance. There's nothing passive about it. And, yeah, it can succeed. It is more challenging now, you know. It's more of a risk now. The police are much more militarized now than they were, you know, before 9/11. And they certainly were, in many cases, very brutal with the Occupy movement. There are also many cases I saw where the Occupy movement succeeded in not getting thrown out by the police and resisting what the police were going to do. I think if a movement is coherent and if a movement actually you know, has a strong sense of collective organizing and solidarity and good process for decision making. It can stand up to a lot of violence and a lot of what gets directed at it. But, you know, for me, that was one reason why I wrote the Empowerment Manual. I had no idea the Occupy movement was going to happen when it was coming out. But what I saw in the Occupy movement kind of reaffirmed for me the reasons why I wrote it was that I saw so many groups struggling with these issues of how do we get along together? How do we resolve conflicts? How do we make decisions together? If we're going to organize horizontally, how do we actually make that work? And, you know, my own feeling about the Occupy movement was that it never really had a chance to resolve those issues. It was struggling so much with its own issues around governance, around effective decision-making, around how to effectively hold boundaries with people and still allow people a sense of autonomy and empowerment, that, you know, that it made it much more vulnerable to that kind of police violence than it might have been if it had been able to develop more of that kind of coherence.
So let me ask you, did the Tea Party succeed in getting people in office and writing laws and obstructing government because they really weren't a grassroots movement like Occupy was? You know, they were really just, you know, moneyed, Koch brother, you know, organized faux movement. Was that the difference?
I mean, I would say yes. I mean, I think there are some grassroots elements in the Tea Party, but it's a movement that's extremely well funded by people who, you know, have interests that are not the interests of the grassroots. Where something like the Occupy movement and these protest movements, you know, it's like you're swimming upstream, you know, mm-hmm. against the tide of resources and money and media and everything else that's going against you.
Yeah. Well, the Tea Party had Fox News on their side.
Yeah.
So the Fifth Sacred Thing, tell us where is it now in production? I mean, is there any chance we're going to see it anytime soon? I think you need funding too, don't you?
We're in the process of looking for investors, and we are looking now, moving into the phase where we're going to be looking to find a director and start finding some of the key roles and key cast and crew. So, you know, it's still in what we call development, but it's moving along. And, you know, we've
now,
made a lot of...
Now, are you a Kickstarter or Indiegogo or something like that where people can send funds?
We don't at the moment. We did a Kickstarter in 2011 that was very successful. But now we're looking more for investment rather than donations. But if people are interested in donating, you can go to our website, thefifthsacredthing.com, and you can donate directly there. And
so what does that mean? You don't need donations, you need investment.
You know, with an investment, somebody puts in money with the assumption they're going to get money back if the thing is successful, but will lose it if the thing doesn't happen, right? So
I see. Okay, yeah. As opposed to just a donation and invest
yeah,
and make
donation,
it something back.
Yeah, donation, you give money and you might get a tax deduction, although you can't get a tax deduction for donating directly to the film, but the film, because we have a vision of doing this film in a way that embodies the values that the film is talking about, we're also in the process of setting up a foundation, and we do have a nonprofit arm that is working already with young people in inner city San Francisco, teaching permaculture and gardening and horticulture skills so that we can help train some of the people who we might be able to eventually hire to build sets for a transformed city that's, you know, become a giant garden. And we have the vision of being able to leave some of those garden legacies for people so that we won't just be building sets and tearing them down, but we'll be transforming places that can actually remain after the movie's done.
Okay. Kind of like the Hobbits in Lord of the Rings out in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So if all went well, do you have any sense of how long it would be before we'd actually see it?
If all went well, we would probably be shooting like in 2014, and you might see it in 2015.
Okay, that's not that far away. Time flies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've often thought of Avatar as Goddess Church.
Uh-huh.
And I can see where this would be eco-feminist spirituality church.
Uh-huh.
It's a shame you couldn't get somebody like, you know, John Cameron. Isn't that John Cameron? Didn't he
James
do Avatar?
James Cameron.
Yeah. You know, somebody who doesn't need the money, who just believes in the cause, you know, who has that kind of clout. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be incredible?
Yeah, well, we're certainly looking for those people. Yes. You know, if anyone out there is listening, feel free to contact us.
So now let me ask you, have you been up to any activism lately?
Well, I have been writing pretty intensely this last spring, so I've mostly been, I kind of had to reconcile myself to the fact that if I was going to write a sequel to The Fifth Sacred Thing, which I'm doing, I actually had to write it and focus on that.
So sequel, so does that mean The Fifth Sacred Thing is sort of a cliffhanger?
Well, it's not exactly a cliffhanger in that it comes to resolution at the end, but there's still more to be done.
Right.
After the book and the movie are over, you know, the North comes to resolution, but there's still this fascist system in the Southland, so... The sequel is about going down and the struggle to liberate the Southland.
Okay.
And I felt I owed it to L.A. since...
Have to redeem us.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in L.A. I didn't, you know, mainly used it because I needed two locations I knew really well. And
right.
That was Northern and Southern California.
Well, but, you know, I have to tell you, just from my own perspective, it seems like Northern California does have it much more together than down here in Southern California. And it may just be my own perception. You know, I mean, we're struggling to get a goddess conference together, the first one, you know.
Uh-huh.
And look at all the things that happen in Northern California. It, you know, we're so close together, but sometimes it seems we're so far apart.
Uh-huh. It's true. But you do have... You know, there's a tremendous amount of really amazing creative people in Southern California. And, you know, I am spending more time down there now that we're working on making the movie. And that's been fun to discover and connect with people down there.
So was it hard to, I mean, did you actually have any film school, or did you learn on the job? I mean, how did you become a filmmaker?
Well, I actually did go to graduate school in film at UCLA back in the late medieval period, many, many, many years ago. And then I worked with Donna Reed on three of the major documentaries she did for the National Film Board of Canada on the Goddess Movement, Goddess Remembered, Burning Times, and Full Circle. And then she and I made two documentaries together, Signs Out of Time, which is the story of Maria Gimbutas, who's the archaeologist who did so much of the work on the goddess, and then Permaculture, The Growing Edge, which is our latest. So I've had experience in documentary filmmaking and writing and some teaching and training. But it's definitely a big leap to step into filmmaking on this level.
I bet. Especially, I mean, the bar is so high, you know. Well, now, I think I remember seeing the trailer. It's been a long time ago, so forgive me if I've totally made this up in my brain. But Is it actually actors, or is it sort of, did it look sort of animated?
Well, what we have is not a trailer, but people can go to our website and see it, because we intend to make a live-action feature film, but you can't really make a trailer until you shot the film, because you need to have the actors and the sets and everything. But what we have is more like a teaser. It's got some of the conceptual art and the music, and we've got Olympia Dukakis doing the narration. And it was really something we put together so that when we're pitching the film to production companies and investors, we can show them something, give them a feel and a sense of what the film's going to be like. And we wanted to be able to show the people who did donate to our Kickstarter campaign, you know, some of the music and some of the art and some of the concepts we put together with the money that we got from that campaign.
Okay. Well, shifting gears just a little bit, but maybe not so much, for anybody out there who wants to be more active, you know, as an activist, or, you know, maybe they don't want to leave their sofa, but they want to at least be putting the, you know, the right energy into the world. What's your advice? Where do they go if they want to actually physically get involved? Who do they help? What do they do? Or if they just want to stay home in front of their computer, what can they do?
Well, I would suggest people check the website 350.org. Because I think one of the big issues right now is climate change, and they are doing some really great organizing around that. In fact, there is actually an action this weekend in the Bay Area at Chevron that a lot of people will be going to, and hopefully I'll be going there to support people around that. And, you know, I think that's a great way to get involved. If people just want to stay on their sofa, I mean, there's just so many different places, you know, so many constant appeals for petitions and money and everything else that come through. I'm not, you know, I'm sure those things don't do any harm. They might do some good, but an actual phone call does a lot more than an online petition, a letter, you know, showing up, getting out there, doing something. It means a lot more.
You know, let me tell me if I'm thinking wrong about this. You know, recently there was some women's rallies in LA, and they were organized by different groups. So you had these small little pockets of people in several different places, rather than everybody getting together and making one big march. That feels like that's diluting the energy to me. But am I thinking about that wrong? Wouldn't it be better if everybody got together and it looked like we had more numbers?
I mean, I would say it depends. You know, sometimes it's very, very powerful to get a lot of people together. Sometimes there are reasons why it's just more effective to organize more decentralized kinds of actions. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on 2016. Do you think it's going to be Hillary? Would that be your choice, or is it too early to say anything about that?
I would imagine Hillary will run for the Democrats, but I don't really know. It is a little too early for me to really have thought a lot about that.
Well, I know there was a lot of controversy, you know, for the last presidential election. I remember, and I read some of your posts about, you know, even though you were more in alignment with the Green Party, you didn't want to help the Republicans, and I felt the exact same way. It feels so challenging, almost impossible for the Green Party or some other third party to get enough clout, to get enough money to really do anything about our political system. I mean, do you think the real energy ought to be put in campaign finance reform, or do you think it's in a third party?
I would probably say that unless we get campaign finance reform, there's really no chance for a third party to do anything. And, you know, I think that overturning Citizens United is really a vital step if we're going to even get some pretense of democracy back.
Right, so, yeah. Right. Do you have any idea how that's moving along? I haven't really been following that so much.
Mm-hmm. I know that there have been different states, I think, who have voted to say that corporations are not people. So I think it's making some progress.
But it moves at a glacier's pace, all
yeah.
of this. Well, Starhawk, it's been great. Is there anything else you want to share about the film or activism or politics or anything that I haven't thought to ask you?
Well, I'd like to share a little llama spell. I'm working with some friends around protecting the seed at this time
okay.
of harvest. And maybe just ask people to close their eyes and envision a seed that you might plant, seed of something you might eat. And take a moment and really honor the mystery and the wonder at the heart of that seed. The wisdom that it embodies. The billions of years of evolution that have gone into it. And take a breath. And I would like to call on Demeter, who is the goddess of the grain and the agriculture, to honor and protect those seeds, to protect the integrity of their DNA, to protect the mystery at the heart of how they reproduce themselves generation upon generation, to protect the gifts of the ancestors that have over time slowly bred the seeds and the plants to fit the particular niches, to fit in different places where they grow. And I'd like to call on Demeter, the Demeter who rages, who sits down at the gates of Alestis and says, nothing will grow until I get my daughter back. I'd like to call on Demeter, that Demeter, to protect the seeds by withholding fertility from those institutions that would pollute them, that would desecrate them, that would attempt to impose their control or their will on others, that would attempt to own them and hold them as their own property and not honor them as the common gift that they are of the goddess. And on this night of Lammas, this time of harvest when we stand between hope and fear, may we all honor and protect the sacred seed. Blessed be.
Blessed be. And may people wake up and realize that we don't have to worry about what are they saying in the news? If we have labels on our food, it might make our food cost more. I mean, please, mm-hmm. wouldn't you rather know what you're putting in your mouth, even if it is going to cost you a little bit more?
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, crazy stuff, I'll tell you. The propaganda out there is just so well financed.
It is.
Well, thank you so very much. You were about to say something. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'd say it is well-financed, but there is also another kind of power that exists in truth and that exists in people speaking, connecting to each other heart to heart and mind to mind and hand to hand. And I hope everyone who's listening will feel empowered sometime this Lammas season to go out and raise your voice in the service of the goddess, in the service of balance, and the service of justice.
Like I say, find your sacred roar. Thank you so much. I appreciate
you
taking the time to be on the show and give us an update on the film. I can't wait.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I'm sure you enjoyed that as much as I did. And as we're waiting for Mel Grisada to phone in, because we do have a few minutes, I thought I would read to you what the values of the feminine consciousness or the sacred feminine as deity, archetype, and ideal, what these values are. Here's just some of them. I'm sure you can add to the list. Partnership, balance, wholeness, justice, diversity, interconnection, reciprocity, caring and sharing, valuing peripheral thinking, equality, negotiation, harmony, peace, nurturing, creativity, compassion, environmentalism, support life-affirming views, seeing our bodies as sacred, embracing sacred sexuality. It's about the us and the we, not the I and the me. It's tolerance. It's about worker rights and women's rights and gay rights and immigrant rights and animal rights and consumer protection and economic parity. It's a right to health care, a right to education, a right to contraception, abortion, and reproductive health. It's transparency and accountability in government and corporate America. It's a strong social safety net. It's women and children at the center of society. Well, if you hold these values in high regard, then perhaps you're an advocate of the sacred feminine and her ideals. You know, I also have another list. What denying the sacred feminine, coupled with a male-dominated society, what that has cost women. Here's 21 sins and inhumanities against women today. Domestic violence and sexual abuse. Female genital mutilation, 70% of women retire in poverty. Women's leadership is thwarted, and while being the majority on the planet, there's less than 20% representation by women in Congress, corporate America, and religious institutions and academia. Women and children are at the margins of society the world over, suffering from the worst health care, education, and human rights. White women are paid only 74 cents on the dollar compared to men, and less if they're Hispanic and black. So they have no independence. You know, they're under the thumb of patriarchy. Lots of times it's white men. There's bride burning and arranged marriages. Women may be shunned from families or seen to bring shame to their family if they've been raped or believed to have committed adultery. Tragic consequences for them can include being stoned to death. We have a distorted view of women and sexuality, resulting in obsessive and unhealthy pornographic industry. Some women in different parts of the world, including here in the United States, are being duped by the new feminism that actually encourages submissiveness and dependence. We have human trafficking, aka slavery and forced prostitution. We have some women that are taught grounds for divorce might be abandonment or adultery, but not abuse. What kind of message does that send? What does she have to tolerate under her own roof? Boy children are valued while female babies are still killed at birth in poor countries because they may cost the family an expensive marriage dowry later in life. In places like India and China, that's resulted in more men with out the options of getting married because there's a shortage of women. Sexuality is dirty and unclean, and by association in some places, so too are women, menstruation, and female reproduction. The menstrual hut is alive and well in lots of different parts of the world. And please don't think all of these things are just in other third world countries. A lot of them are just not. Women are still in danger of losing access to contraceptives and are losing access to abortion. Well, you got to know that is happening all across the United States as states who are controlled by Republicans are just going crazy with this kind of stuff. That's the only thing they're passing in their legislatures is anti-women legislation. There's a distorted view of beauty that has millions of women with eating disorders and with them flocking to cosmetic surgeons. Women and attributes equated with the feminine consciousness are seen as inferior to men, with far-reaching consequences for both genders. Number 18, rape is used as a weapon of war. Number 19, programming of women to help perpetuate this list of sins, rather than encouraging self-empowerment, independence, and a climate where women support women. We call these women their handmaidens of the patriarchy. Republicans continue to refuse to pass pro-women legislation. We barely got the Violence Against Women Act passed. We certainly cannot get equal pay for equal work legislation passed because they only care about the corporations. They don't care about average people. And finally, number 21 on the list, as we have forgotten the value in the belief of the interconnectedness of all things, so too have we diminished the role of women as life givers in the natural order of the universe. This all being said, how might things change if we were in a world with a feminine face of God restored in equality alongside the divine masculine? Let's put Goddess and God in their rocking chairs, side by side, together again. What do you think? You know, because it's humanity that divorced them. It wasn't them. So I think perhaps my second guest is here on the switchboard. Let me just double check before we go any further.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, is this Mal Gurzada?
Hi. Mal Gurzada is here, yes.
Hi, welcome. Welcome to the show. I wanted to make sure that was you. And I'm going to be with you in just a minute. As we cross the threshold into the second half of the show, we have a short commercial from Joe Carson.
Most people see humankind as really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree is. When I came out of it, this is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, that's those mountains, tall backs, Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are some of the opening words from the DVD called Dancing with Gaia by Joe Carson. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do just that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning, and I can definitely confirm that. I've seen it. The DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and it is only $20, a real bargain. I highly recommend it for anyone's library. Learn more about connecting with the landscape of the goddess internally and externally. Go to dancingwithgaia.com if you'd like more information about the DVD, Dancing with Gaia, or if you'd like to order it. So I want to introduce you to our next guest by way of her bio. And I hope I don't murder her name. I'll let her correct me when she comes back on, and so we can get the proper pronunciation of her name. I'm going to try, though. It's Mal Gurzada Olaskiewicz Peralba, an associate professor of Latin American literary and cultural studies at the Department of Modern Languages and Literatures at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She's lived, studied, and traveled widely around the world and is fluent in seven languages. Her cross-cultural comparative research on syncretic religions, rituals, and the divine dark feminine took her to conduct fieldwork in Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Uruguay, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Spain, France, Poland, Russia, and Lithuania, among others. She is the author of The Black Madonna in Latin America and Europe, Tradition and Transformation, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Teatro Popular Pirano del Precolombio al Siglo 20. I don't know what that is. She'll have to tell us, but that was published by Warsaw University and the Austrian Institute of Latin America, as well as numerous scholarly articles, lectures, and conference presentations. She's just finished a book, manuscript, on the representations of the divine, fierce feminine around the world. And tonight we are going to be talking about the worship of the Black Madonnas around the world, featured in her book, The Black Madonna in Latin America and Europe, Tradition and Transformation. So welcome to the show, Malgorzata.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just ask you, Malgorzata is a mouthful. Do your friends call you Malgorzata, or is there a nickname for you?
Usually they call me Malgorzata, although there are about 15 nicknames that I could be called. But they're not always easier than the official name.
Then all right, we'll just stick with Malgorzata. The more I say it, the easier it rolls off the tongue.
Exactly.
So, you know, I originally reached out to you, Malgorzata, because one of my listeners brought your work to my attention. She sent me a link. The listener was Christina Bali, and she sent me a link about your work because we were talking about La Santa Muerte, a modern manifestation of the dark goddess archetype. And I'm really curious about that because it really sort of goes to the heart of the idea, do we create deities or do deities create us? Because this is a modern manifestation, correct? So in a sense, human beings have created La Santa Muerte?
Okay, Santa Muerte, this means holy death. It's a new devotion that started in Mexico City, in the marginal neighborhood, probably in the 1950s, in its modern form. But it has predecessor, of course, in medieval Europe, in the Aztec gods and goddess of the underworld also. So there is a long history that led to this figure. But there are reasons why she became a new unofficial saint in the 20th century.
All right, well, I think you're on Skype. It might help a little bit if you put the microphone kind of close to your mouth. If you can get a little bit closer to the mic because your sound, that's much better. I think that sounds much better because you were sounding very far away. That's so much better.
Okay. Good. All right. So you would like me to talk about Santa Muerte?
Yeah, explain to us how this new saint came to be in the modern world.
Yes, that's very interesting because there are reasons why this unofficial saint became so popular in 20th century Mexico and surrounding countries, including the U.S. and Guatemala, El Salvador. And now, I said it started around mid-century, but the biggest popularity and like a culmination happened just in the last 20 and especially in the last 10 years. Now, this saint, it's kind of a saint of last resort. When nothing else works, devotees turn to her. And I have a quote, for example. This is a testimony from one of the devotees from Tepito, which is a marginal neighborhood in Mexico City. He says, "I don't know if God exists, but death, yes, death is stronger than life, as she puts an end to it. In view of a lack of meaning of life, there is an excess of meaning of death." And the devotees It started as a more private call that had to do with love and love magic or sexual magic, but it spread to all the sectors of society, especially to the sectors of society that deal with transitions, transgressions, liminality, travel, groups that are in between, especially that are on the streets. And that includes all kinds of people, could be street vendors, homosexuals, criminals, and prostitutes, but also other occupations like migrants, truck drivers, policemen, troops, prison guards, psychologists, and recently also lawyers. And it's very popular for lawyers to place her image in their office, and there's even a color for that, the color specific for each purpose and each situation.
So, hang on. Let me just ask you. So, did you say a moment ago that, okay, so Santa Muerta means the saint of death, correct?
Santa Muerte means holy death.
Okay, holy death. And so, did you say that they are drawn to her because they feel like death is more powerful or stronger than life? So they think by revering her, their petitions may have a better chance of being answered?
They believe she's stronger. She's the strongest because nobody escapes death. So she's the ultimate thing. The only sure thing in life is death. But that has to do with the situation of very precarious situation of life and the closeness to danger and death that has developed in Mexico, especially in the latest decades. That has to do with the drug trafficking, the kidnapping. You never know if the police or the troops are on the side of the people or the drug traffickers or both. It's a very precarious situation. I also believe it has to do with globalization and NAFTA, the North American Trade Agreement, that ruined small businesses. Therefore, there are many people that don't have employment, that they are totally desperate, like never before.
So in other words, as people live on the edge, as their lives are less secure and their very survival is more precarious, they're drawn to new archetypes like this.
Yes, exactly. And the situation is very precarious, it's very insecure, and for the first time, I think, in Mexican history, since the colonial times, it involves all groups and social classes and racial groups because the violence that has developed involves every group in Mexico today and also on the borders and near the borders and also in Central America. So that's why I believe this thing is so popular. Another reason is that she's not she's very impartial. She doesn't judge. And one of my informants told me, in fact, in San Antonio, because she's very popular here, although she's more hidden than in Mexico, where she's all over in the streets everywhere and in the market. She told me that there are things that the Virgin of Guadalupe, who is the one that traditionally was, everybody would report to her, that she cannot do for you, but Santa Muerte can.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the things some people say about the Black Madonnas is the Black Madonna is different from the regular Madonna because you can tell the Black Madonna things that you might not say to the regular Madonna. You know, she, the Black Madonna, understands the hardships of life better. I had a woman who say, you know, she would feel more comfortable, for instance, as an example, telling the Black Madonna, praying to the Black Madonna about her angst about having to have an abortion or maybe horrible things that have happened to her, like being molested, or it's the darker things in life that you can tell the Dark Madonna. And I'm hearing that maybe is the same with the Santa Muerta. Do you agree there? And if you do, do you sort of see a parallel between the Black Madonna and the Santa Muerta?
Okay. Well, actually, Muerta means something different than Muerte. So it's Muerte, N-T-C. But, well, there may be some similarities of the kind that you are describing. But basically, the Black Madonna is the Virgin Mary. But it's more, I believe it's a more authentic image of the Madonna, more connected to the ancient goddesses, mother goddesses, because the Black Madonnas or the Virgin Marys are never called Virgin Mary, for example, in Eastern Europe. They are always called Mother of God or God's birth giver, which is very close to Mother Goddess. So, and even in their physical representations are almost identical to ancient Mother Goddesses like Isis or Inanna and Panic, and many, many images of mother goddesses from ancient times have exactly the same posture. They're seated on a throne, they're crowned, they hold the divine child on their lap. And they do have, it's true that, for example, the Polish Black Madonna, many Black Madonnas have a very, they're older women, with severe look on their face. Even the Polish Black Madonna, the one of the Polish Black Madonnas, the main one, which is Madonna of Częstochowa, she has three cuts on her cheek, like wounds. She has three wounds on her cheek that are interpreted in many different ways, as you can imagine, by different groups of people. But yes, you are right. She is the Black Madonna is always identified with the helper, with the fighter for justice, the protector of the dispossessed and the poor. She's the nourisher, the loving one, etc. But with Santa Muerte is a little different because the whole situation is taken much farther. Because Black Madonna is an official saint, is the Virgin Mary, but Santa Muerte is totally rejected by the church. She is actually demonized. She's being presented as the antithesis of a saint, and she's being combated because.
Why do you think that is?
Well, she threatens the first of all, the order, the official order of things, because she became extremely popular extremely fast. So that is very dangerous. But also the pretext that usually is given is that she's associated with crime and drug trafficking. But I don't see this is really her main function. She's also worshipped by people from those circles, but she also is worshipped by many just regular people, housewives and you know, people that are in danger, and they feel like it's a paradox because they're recurring to death as the protector of life.
Right. Well, and I could see where drug traffickers may actually pray to Our Lady of Guadalupe. You know, I mean, because Guadalupe, so I mean, it's sort of the same thing. Just because drug traffickers may find, you know, her an attractive, you know, saint, it doesn't make her the saint of drug traffickers.
No, absolutely not. And also, it's true that many of the drug traffickers are very religious, and they always pray to the Virgin of Guadalupe. And other saints. Some of them are official, some of them are not official, like other figures. Santa Muerte is not the only one. There are others like Pedrito Jaramillo, Jesús Malverde, many of them.
The one you mentioned in the information you sent to me, I'm a little bit aware of, and some of my listeners might be aware of, it's the Sara Lacalle from southern France, La Sainte Marie de la Mer. I mean, that sort of has connections to Mary Magdalene, correct?
Yes, that is very interesting. The only thing they have in common is that they are unofficial saints. They are not accepted by the church, although Sara Lacalle is kind of co-opted by the Catholic Church in southern France, and even masses are performed for her. The legend says that Sara was a servant or a black servant to the Marys, to Marie Jacobet, Marie Salome, and she came on that boat with Marie Magdalene and many other people. But the curious thing that at Les Saintes Marie de la Mer in southern France, Mary Magdalene has been completely eliminated from the picture. Nobody mentions her. She's not on the portraits of. There is no such thing. But I did go to her sanctuary, her basilica, which is much way to the north, closer to Marseille, actually, Les Saint-Maximin. And there are parades made there. Actually, they parade her skull and her bones dressed in a golden mask.
Would you say that the church sort of tolerates her because of her popularity, because it means a lot of money for them in the pilgrimages to her sacred site?
Actually, Sara Lacalle is a very curious devotion because she's the patroness of the Roma, of the gypsies. And in a given pilgrimage, there may be 40,000 people that come to Les Saintes Marie de la Mer, which is a small town, and they stay there like for 2 weeks to be present at her feast on 24th of May. And there is a mass, there is a procession to the sea, and it's led by the Catholic Church. And actually, this procession is very similar to the procession performed for Kali and Durga in Calcutta. It's almost identical in terms of the actions that they do, including submerging her into the waters. I think she's like on the margin of between official acceptance and sanction, which means that the Catholic Church would like to have these devotees that come to see her as Catholics. So it allows them to come to the church and it kind of includes her. And her statue is in the church, but she's in the subterranean crypt of the church, which used to be a very ancient pagan site for the goddess with Cybele and other goddesses in Roman times, and also it represents the womb of the earth, which is typical that the black Madonnas are placed in in caves, in grottos, and in subterranean crypts. So she has, and this region is very abundant in black Madonnas. South where France and northern Spain is extremely abundant. So people refer to her, some people I heard referring to her as the Black Madonna. But she also is called La Cali, which means the black one. And but she's worshipped by everybody. I have seen the nomads from Kenya. I have seen anti-globalization youth from Spain. I have seen many different groups of people from all over the world. Candomblé devotees from Salvador Bahia. This is the religion that Iemanjá is from, for example, that I studied also in my book. I just came back from Santiago de Compostela in Spain, that the Museum of Pilgrimage has organized a photo exhibit and a press conference. I wrote a text about this. It was all about Sara La Cali and the pilgrimage, the unofficial pilgrimage in southern France. So I like it because
some of the other archetypes or identities or goddesses that you list under the divine fierce feminine that are demonized, sweetened, ridiculed, or dismissed. You have Baba Yaga there, and also Pombagira from Brazil. You know, these are two goddesses we don't always hear a lot about. Did you want to talk a little bit about them?
Just
talk into the mic, okay?
Okay, well, I don't know. Okay, they are totally fascinating. For example, Pombagira is a kind of a holy harlot in Brazil. She's an entity from the Umbanda religion, which is a very, it's a 20th century, very syncretic religion that combines Catholicism with African beliefs, with native Brazilian, and also spirits from Europe, from Allan Kardec. She is an entity. People, usually women, enter, some people can enter into trance and incorporate her during the ceremony. And she is a prototype of a prostitute, of a woman of the street. But she's also believed to be the most powerful of all of them. But she has been, of course, demonized by the general population that is not part of that religion, treats her as a female demon. She demon, right? She devil. And she has a male counterpart. This male counterpart is Exu. It's an African god, basically. It's not a devil. It's a trickster god that is neither good nor bad. And he opens the ways on the crossroads for any new enterprise. He's given reverence before any ceremony can start. So it's a very important and powerful god. But here in Brazil, he has a female counterpart. And what I found in Brazil, that in Brazil there is a lot of, these religions are mostly matriarchal, especially Candomblé is a totally matriarchal religion. It's led by older black women that are usually heavy. So it's just the antithesis of what is being promoted as the ideal for women today, right?
Right. Well, I wonder with Pombagira, is it like in the Candomblé? Doesn't the deity or the Loa, I'm not sure what the proper term is, but the spirit of the goddess inhabit some of the the congregants, the devotees?
Yes, I just said, yes, they enter into trance incorporating these gods and goddesses. That's exactly it. So they adopt the personality of the goddess or the entity. It's a little different in the Candomblé than in the Umbanda, because in the Candomblé, which is believed to be totally African, but of course it's also syncretic, it comes from the Yoruba culture of Western Africa. The people that enter into trance, they incorporate the gods and goddesses, spirits, but gods and goddesses, through the sacred energy Ashe. But in the Umbanda, these entities, like Pombagira, they are believed to be spirits of people, of deceased people, or people that live. It could be legendary figures, for example, but they are believed to be actual spirits.
The others you wanted to talk about were Our Lady of Chestacawa in Guadalupe and Nyamaya in Aparecida. Do those three have anything in common?
Yes, they have a lot in common. Lady of Chestacawa I already discussed. This is the Black Madonna. She's a Catholic Virgin Mary, but it's an more ancient representation of her, closer to the goddesses. And she's all over Europe in different countries, and she's the Lady of Chestacawa is only one. It's in Poland, but similar images of Black Madonnas exist all over Europe in countries where the population is totally white. Exclusively white. And then Our Lady of Guadalupe, I put together because I think they have so much in common that they are totally analogous. Although the Lady of Guadalupe looks differently, she's more like Inmaculada, toda pulcra, because she's in a standing position and she's alone.
Let me ask you about Guadalupe. Two questions.
Yes.
I believe that she's probably a syncretization with Tononzin, the Aztec goddess. Confirm that if you will, if I have that right. And also, mm-hmm. I wonder if you consider her a Black Madonna.
Well, she's a dark Madonna. She's not completely black. She's a dark Virgin Mary, so she's very similar in that way. But her history is very similar also, and her functions, first of all, are very similar, because she's the protectress of the dispossessed, of the poor, of the people who are the smallest. And usually these Madonnas are found or seen by Indians, children, or shepherds, so the dispossessed of the society. That was also the story of the Lady of Guadalupe. But the one thing they had in common, the Polish Lady of Częstochowa and Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico, is that they are both used as an element that agglutinates the society, like a uniting element of different parts of society. In Mexico is because Mexico was created from different races and cultures that were put together, and they had to have an agglutinatory element, which became the Lady of Guadalupe. And also she defended them from foreign invasions and all kinds of hardships. And in Poland, the Lady of Częstochowa has a very patriotic role also, because Poland was divided among three powerful nations in Europe for 150 years and then passed through two World Wars, and it didn't exist on the map that the Polish people were able to conserve their nationality, their feeling and language and everything else through the belief in Our Lady of Częstochowa. So the religion served the purpose of national identity. And Guadalupe also is a symbol of national identity in Mexico.
Okay.
But I want to talk about Lady of Guadalupe is totally syncretic. She is actually a blend of Tonan Cinquatlicue and a Christian Virgin Mary. And because, for example, she has a turquoise robe. No Virgin Mary has a turquoise robe. She has a blue robe, usually, a mantle. But turquoise is a sacred color of the Aztecs, and she has the
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear you. Could you repeat that, please?
I'm saying that the mantle of the Virgin of Guadalupe is different from the mantle of the other Virgin Marys from Europe because it's turquoise. Turquoise is a very, very important and symbolic sacred color of the Aztecs.
Oh, turquoise, turquoise, okay.
Yes. And then she also has the elements of the moon, sun, and the stars that are also very important symbols for the Aztec religion, and also other colors. So what happens is that she can appeal to the people who believe in a different religion at the same time. This is the way that she could unite the Catholics, the European, the Creoles, but also the Indians from Mexico in the beginning. But in fact, there are proofs that she has been actually painted by an Indian, famous Indian painter, her painting was commissioned by the colonial authorities, the church, and she was painted by the Indian Marcos de Aquino. It's in the chronicle of Bernal Diaz de Castillo. She looks totally similar, almost identical to a Virgin Mary that is in a banner of Cortes, that Cortes, the conqueror of Mexico, brought to in his campaign. So I think that was the model, because she looks more like a Mediterranean Virgin Mary figure from that that time. But the colors have been added that appeal to the Indian and the symbol.
So she becomes common ground between the indigenous people and some of the other groups.
Yes, all the groups. Have her as a symbol of protection, identity, etc. Mm-hmm.
So we probably have about 5 minutes left here, Melgazorda. Time goes by so quick. What did you want to tell us about Yemaya and Aparecida?
Well, Yemaya is the one that is very interesting. It's the goddess that is also very syncretic. She came from Western Africa as a combination of Mamiwata and Yemoya from Africa. But she has been transformed through the passage through the Atlantic with the African slave, and she became kind of a queen of Brazil, like a national deity of Brazil. And usually she's portrayed as a white woman with a long hair wearing a blue robe, which is totally different from her origin. But this is the image that is most known. So what happens is that these figures are very dynamic, and when they blend with other figures, for example, in Latin America, through colonialism, they change, and there's some of their functions and attributes are lost, others are added, and a new figure, a new religion is created. because Iemanjá, during the ceremonies, she wears Baroque clothes from the colonial era. It's totally stunning. And she performs some African dances. When people enter into trance with her, they incorporate her. Truly the most striking.
Okay.
She's the queen of the salty waters. Okay, the last thing is she's the mother goddess, one of the trinity of goddesses. As in all of these cultures, the goddesses come in trinities, the young, the mother, and the old woman, and they are all connected to water. Now, she looks a little similar to the Virgin Mary, but she has deep breath, she has hips, very sexual, and she also expresses all of the things that the Virgin Mary doesn't. For example, rage, she can give death to people in the ocean, she can be very kind, she can be very... So, basically, with the Virgin Mary, only the traits that have been left is humility, motherliness, and nurture. But with these goddesses, you have the other threats that still are there, the ancient
right.
ones, the power, the wisdom, the connection with death, connection with sexuality, and sometimes fury.
So she's much more whole.
Much more complete, yes.
Yeah, much more complete, absolutely. So, Malgorzato, if someone were interested in your book, if you would share the title with us again, is it available on Amazon or where would they get it?
Yes, well, the book is available on Amazon, on University of New Mexico Press. I believe Barnes & Noble should have it also. And the title is
Black Madonnas, Unofficial Saints, and Fierce Feminine Divinities.
Excuse me?
Isn't that it?
American Europe, Tradition and Transformation. That's the book we were talking about. It has two printings, 2007 and 2009. Now, did you ask me about the last one? About the fierce feminine?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Okay, I'll be talking louder then.
What was your question?
I thought you asked me a question that I didn't hear. It was
No. We just wanted to say the title of your book, The Black Madonnas in Latin America and Europe, Tradition and Transformation. And do you have a website, Malgorzato, by any chance?
No, I don't have a website. No.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for, I know it's difficult, you know, you were calling in on Skype and sometimes the connections aren't always clear, but, you know, we do what we have to do to get the information, and I'm sure my listeners appreciate you calling in, you know, to tell us about some of these saints and goddesses that, you know, aren't always as common as some of the others. So thank you. Thank you so much for calling in tonight.
Thank you, and I hope that the quality of voice was acceptable.
Yeah,
and,
I think we got most of it, you know, and people can always, you know, play it back and listen again if they feel like maybe they missed something. I'm sure, you know, they can catch it the second time.
Okay, and also this material is published in many articles, and in the book, and soon I hope there will be the next book about the fierce feminine. So, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you calling in. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, listeners, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to share with you a prayer that comes from Sandra Sariel, the abbess of the Abbey of Avalon, which is a women's Dianic group down here in Southern California. Since we were talking so much about goddesses, especially with that with our last guest, Malgorzato, the prayer is called Hail Goddess, And it goes like this. Hail, Goddess, full of grace, my heart is with thee. Holy One, giver of life and love, my heart is with thee. Blessed are your children of love, and blessed are your holy names. My heart is with thee. Holy One, we pray to thee, give us this day your sacred love. Guide our path with your holy hands. My heart is with thee. Thy will be done, thy blessings and protection mine. My soul is thine. My heart is with thee. Hail, Goddess, full of grace. Blessed are your holy names, always and forever. My heart is with thee. So that's a prayer from the Abbey of Avalon Abbess, Sandra Sariel, called Hail, Goddess. Well, as we come to the close of tonight's show, I hope you will have a wonderful Lammas. And I hope you are marking your calendars, because October is not that far away. It is going to be here before we know it. And I hope you have saved the date, October 6th, for the Pagan Pride Day at Rainbow Lagoon in Long Beach, if you're in Southern California. The Pagan Pride Day people received a lot of positive feedback about that new location there at the Rainbow Lagoon Park. So they're back there again with workshops, entertainment, rituals, authors, and sacred shopping. What could be better? As always, it's free. It's family-friendly, and the event is open to the public. You can help by bringing a non-perishable food item for the food bank, because it's also a food drive. This is your opportunity to bring family, friends, acquaintances, to give them a feel for what life as a pagan is about, or just to hang out and buy cool stuff from our vendors. They have Pagan Pride Day to provide a place for pagans to gather, to socialize, network, and shop. It's a place where people who are new to the community can make new connections and friends. The opportunity to learn from respected teachers in our community. It's a space to connect with each other and divine source from different paths during ritual. There's a chance to meet with and talk to your favorite authors. It's a showcase for pagan-related entertainment. And it's a venue for organizations, pagan and non-pagan, to connect with the community. Now, they've invited me back this year, and this year I'm going to be giving a talk about the Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet, because I think it's so important to dispel the misinformation and disinformation about her out there, and especially because she is such an important goddess of feminine empowerment. So I will be doing another show next week on Wednesday. I'm getting a little bit more back on track, so I hope you will join me. And some of you have said you wanted me to talk a little bit about the book, my second book, Walking in Ancient Paths. So since we have a couple minutes, that's one of the books that I have been asking you to help out with. And if we're looking for something for your own library or something for a friend, you know, maybe consider, you know, going to Amazon or from me directly and get a copy of Walking in Ancient Paths. It's divided, actually, into the four elements in spirit. The water section of the book is about our emotions and doing ritual and how our emotions are affected in ritual. It's also about loving ourselves and becoming empowered. The earth section is actually about a lot of the sacred journeys and pilgrimages I've made personally, or I have taken people with me to sacred sites. The fire section is about our will and our strength and our courage, and it's also about politics. The air section is about being inspired by Goddess and hearing her call and different things we can do to honor her. The spirit section is really about how a woman like me can be called from the background of a recovering Catholic that I am, and find myself walking an ancient path of a priestess of Goddess. And so that's sort of what the book is about in a nutshell. It has garnered prestigious endorsements, and it was a finalist in the spirituality category in the USA National Best Books in 2008. And I do have a new book coming out in early 2014. It's going to be called Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology. So, I guess the last thing I would like to remind you of, listeners, I think it's so important as we bring information such as what we talk about on this show to the airwaves, is that we never lose hope, that we remember we are in the cognitive minority. I've said that before, and I'd like to stress it again. You remember when scientists were trying to tell the church that the earth wasn't flat, or that that the planets revolved around the sun, and of course, you know, some of them were thrown in jail or killed because of it. Those scientists who brought the truth were the cognitive minority. I believe that is who we are as we try to rebirth Goddess in our world, as we try to rewrite history, as we try to fight for social justice. So that's why the two mottos of the show are one from Gandhi, which goes like this, because we can never forget this. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Or from the 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, that all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. You know, there was a time when people's lives could be in danger for speaking about Goddess publicly, but those days are gone. And more across continents and cultures, more and more people are embracing the sacred feminine. So we are moving through these three stages. And, you know, remember when Avatar was so popular? You know, Avatar, the movie that I like to call Goddess Church? Well, it made quite an impression, so much of an impression, that the Pope felt that he had to have his spokesman come out and try to remind us that nature would never become religion. That anyway, I think you get my point. Things are changing. Things are shifting. Maybe not quick enough, but they are. So we just have to stay focused. We have to find our sacred roar. We have to be the ones that make this paradigm shift happen. And, you know, when they start to laugh at us and when they start to fight us, it's not long before we win. So thank you very much for listening tonight, and please be with me again next week. If you give me just one second, I'll tell you who our guests are next week. I will have with me Jack Roberts. He is going to be calling in from Ireland. We're going to be talking about Sheila Nagigs. He's one of my guests. And I'll also have Linda Leonard with me. Have lots of great guests in August. So if you're away on vacation, please remember, catch us from the archives. And if you're in a city that is screening the documentary Femme, Women Healing the World, please make sure you catch it. And if you've missed it, pretty soon I'm going to be giving you information about how you can get a copy of the DVD so we can just saturate our living rooms out there in the world with our own private little screenings with our family and friends, so that everybody can see this movie, Femme, Women Healing the World, because it is so, so very important. Well, I guess that, that will cover it for tonight. I'll leave you with some music to close off. Since we've been talking about the dark goddesses, how about I close off with Kali by Diva Haley. Hope you enjoy it, and please come back next week and catch some of these wonderful shows that I've done recently in the archives. Appreciate you, listeners, your guests in my tank. Good night.
Kundalini Shakti Shakti.